Jeff climbed up into the spacecraft. He looked around and was pleasantly surprised to see that it wasn't as cramped or as hairy or indeed as smelly as he thought it might be. In fact, the subtle aroma of hair conditioning products was more like a built-in air freshener. After all, it wouldn't do to be traversing immense galactic distances inside an armpit. He found a place to dump his rucksack and went up front to the cockpit area. He took a seat next to the pilot's chair. It was a converted barber's chair, naturally, and as it had been recently outfitted with seatbelts and a number of control panels, it really looked the part. He still didn't understand much about this crazy ship or his crazy companion, the man from Kangazang. Just when you think you know someone, they turn out to be completely enigmatic. Just then, the walking enigma entered the craft. The door clanged shut, followed by a thin hiss as the oxygen recycler kicked in. Jeff attempted to swallow, but it felt like someone had lodged a small hedgehog in his throat. Strapping himself in, Ray turned to Jeff, who was staring dead ahead and going whiter by the second.
"It'll be all right, Jeff," said Ray, as soothingly as he could. "It's just like riding a bike."
Jeff remained staring and still. A bead of sweat ran down his forehead. "I can't ride a bike, Ray," he muttered through tight lips. Cold, heavy seconds dripped by as Ray checked a variety of switches and lights around him. Jeff cracked.
"Just get on with it," he finally blurted.
"I'm a fairy, and Nuff is my name," replied Ray in victory, and pressed a button on his control panel.
The ship began to vibrate, accompanied by a low rumbling, like distant thunder. Underneath the spacecraft, a timer on the pile of explosives began to tick down. It read 10. Ray counted down the seconds aloud. 9, 8, 7.
"Is it too late to change my mind?" asked Jeff.
"Oh, absolutely. Here we go. 3, 2, 1.
Jeff squeezed his eyes shut. Ray looked rather tense too. Nothing happened. They waited a few more seconds. Still, nothing. Jeff kept his eyes shut.
"What's happening?" he pleaded. Ray, for once, didn't have the foggiest.
He checked the instruments around him.
No, that's okay. So's that one.
Jeff opened his eyes and released his vice-like grip on the armchair.
"So it's not working, then?" he correctly deduced.
Ray unstrapped himself and went to the rear of the ship.
"You stay there. I need to do something back here."
For a couple of minutes, all was silent. Ray was still down the other end of the darkened craft, and Jeff was beginning to get bored. He flicked the tiny furry dice that Ray had hung up on the ceiling.
"Ray," he called. "Do you need any help back there?"
"No, thanks. I'm fine, Jeff."
What are you doing, anyway?"
"Well, if you must know, I'm having a dump."
"Oh, sorry."
Jeff smiled and then chuckled to himself. Twisting around in his seat, he called to Ray.
"Save me some paper, won't you? I might need to go..."
Out in the street, a lone policeman was knocked off his feet by the shockwave. He looked up to see the roof of Ray's lockup shatter into millions of matchsticks and a 30-foot-long Brillo pad shoot up into the air like a cannonball. The spaceship was airborne. Inside the now-floating spacecraft, Ray wailed in panic as he raced back to the pilot's chair, holding his trousers up. He wrestled with the controls and punched buttons all around him frantically. Jeff screamed like a 5-year-old on the ghost train, with real ghosts.
"We're up! It's working!" shouted Ray in triumph.
"No kidding!" screamed Jeff. "What happens now?"
he added, still in his infantile octave. Ray swung his control pad over to the left, then to the right. He stabbed at a couple of buttons above his head, and then the ship stopped shaking. It floated gently upwards for a few hundred feet, and then settled, bobbing softly. This was just one of the miracles of finely woven, electronically stimulated keratin.
"Now we prepare to leave the solar system," smiled Ray. "But first, I need to clean up back there."
Jeff looked out and noticed that the sun was just coming up over the horizon. It looked awesome, and the sunlight bathed the interior of the ship in a golden glow, which warmed the air, and the ship's aroma reminded him of his youthful Sunday nights after a bath, his newly washed mullet smelling of shampoo. This was the weirdest feeling, to actually be the occupant of a flying saucer. Perhaps someone down on the surface was already taking blurry video footage of the strange craft, currently hovering a couple of hundred feet in the air above the town. But who'd believe it? Sarah certainly wouldn't. He thought for a moment, then checked his wallet for currency. "Ray, can we make a quick stop?" Over at her flat, Sarah and Wilson stood on the balcony watching the sunrise.
"This was a perfect night. Thanks for coming round."
"Oh, it was my pleasure entirely."
"Nothing in the world could spoil this moment."
Suddenly, the princely sum of £50 dropped out of the sky, rolled up with an elastic band around the notes. Sarah picked it up and then looked up to see where it could have come from. 200 feet above them, Jeff emptied the chemical toilet. From above, the wicked shall receive their just reward. And so they did. And here endeth the lesson. Approximately 135 parsecs away, within the impressive cluster of youthful stars called the Pleiades, lay the Scraggy Empire, a gigantic galaxy-wide kingdom which had been ruled for millennia by a family of vindictive and savage rulers. The latest in the line was Lord Rancid, victor of countless battles, murderer of billions, and fearful god of war to every nearby system, and father to Kelvin. Rancid lay dying in his jewel-encrusted bed, his feeble son at his side. Kelvin was a little under 30, thin and nervous, and unlike his father, he wasn't really the vindictive and savage type. True, he'd read about countless battles, imagined insulting millions, and tried to be a fearful god of war to the next-door neighbour's pets. But Kelvin was about to inherit the title Lord Rancid III, Overlord of Scrag. In all honesty, he would rather have been reading magazines of dubious subject matter outside in the garden shed. He sat beside the huge bed and watched the hours tick by as his 500-year-old father took thin gasps of air. Kelvin sniffed, in part due to his sorrow at the imminent passing of his old man, and partly because he was trying to work out what the awful smell was. "Father," he asked tenderly, "Father, can you hear me?"
"Most the bloody pity," replied Lord Rancid in a feeble whisper.
He dreaded this day, the day when his glorious reign would come to an end, because it would be utterly ruined by the inauguration of his idiot son. He'd had hamsters that were more evil than Kelvin, a pet slug that was more driven, and now this immature, damp tissue of a boy was soon to be hailed as the supreme overlord of the mighty Scrag Empire. Oh, the shame of it! At this point, he smiled. At least he'd be dead and gone, and not have to live through the humiliation of it all. Kelvin saw the smile, and took it as an indication of love from his dad. He leaned a little closer, cleared his throat, and said his well-rehearsed piece.
Father, I just wanted you to know that when they, I mean when I, become overlord, I'll do my best. I mean my very best. That is, to be a great ruler, like what you was.
So much for the speech.
Dad, this isn't easy for me. I mean, I don't think I'm cut out to be an evil overlord like you. But I have learned a lot, and I can see the rewards, if only in the tax reliefs.
Lord Rancid smiled again. And again Kelvin took this as a sign of his dad's approval, when in actual fact the thought that accompanied it was,
won't be long now. Hurry up, you scythe-wielding bone bag, I'm ready to go.
He coughed again and then spoke.
Kelvin, just remember this, and you will do well. Every time you make a decision, listen to what your heart tells you. Then ignore it and do the complete opposite. Only this will ensure the Empire's future. Don't fail me, son, or I'll be back to haunt the crap out of you forever.
Kelvin nodded sagely. Rancid continued.
If you want to be a success, find the universal remote. Then you can rule over everything and everyone. And for God's sake, don't make a mess of it.
Kelvin took his father's twig-like hands in his own.
I'll find it, Dad. And I'll make you proud. You can count on me. He stood up to show his determination and resolve. I'll rule the Empire as well as anyone. Entire star systems will cower in my shadow as I make the power of my anger known. Races will fall and...
He suddenly looked at his father, motionless and quite dead.
Oh, bugger.
Inside Ray's hovering shredded wheat, Jeff was in tears. Not tears of sorrow, but immense hilarity. He thumped both fists on the arms of his co-pilot's chair as he giggled insanely.
Oh, God! That was just perfect! Absolutely top banana! Oh, my sides! Oh, you should have seen them, Ray! Kersplatch! And they'd no idea what had happened. I bet they thought it was a massive seagull.
He went into fits of laughter again. Ray was smiling. At least Jeff had cheered up, but he did think that dousing one's unfaithful partner with 3 litres of chemically treated human sewage was a little excessive. He sat back down in the pilot's chair and buckled up.
Come on, then. Let's make tracks.
Jeff had lost most of his fear by now and was really looking forward to the trip.
Way! He exclaimed. Say goodbye and good riddance to that pointless armpit of a town, Ray. It's margaritas on the beaches of Shangalang from now on.
Ray considered correcting him by reminding Jeff that his home planet was called Kangazang, but thought it best not to spoil his mood, so he let the Bay City rollerism go uncommented on.
Here we go, Jeff. Full throttle,
announced the pilot. And with a satisfying dose of G-forces, the entire planet seemed to drop away beneath them and become a speck in the distance. Ray's airborne hairball flew onwards and upwards at sphincter-clenching speed. Soon all they could see was a black velvety expanse dotted with twinkling diamonds. Up and down, left and right, there was space. Infinity. Endless void. The temperature in the ship went down by a few degrees, and Jeff noticed this with a shiver.
Forgot me gloves. I guess this is deep space. Is it going to get much colder?
Ray shook his head.
No, I just put the air conditioning on. Can't drive without it, to be honest.
Jeff raised his eyebrows. Aircon? He was impressed.
Do you want to see something interesting? Said Ray, pointing to a grey speck out in front.
Jeff nodded.
What's that then?
We're approaching the moon. Press that orange button in front of you.
Jeff searched for a moment and then pointed to a small, square, orange button that looked like a licorice allsort.
This one?
Ray hummed a sound like a yes as he piloted the ship nearer to the grey ball.
Jeff pushed the button. The windscreen of the spacecraft became active as a grid divided up the previously clear glass. Ray touched one of the squares and it grew larger, magnifying the view by 100 times. Jeff stared in awe, almost entirely speechless. He uttered a soft, "Blimey, Charlie," as he realised he was the first human being in nearly 40 years to look upon the moon's surface with the naked eye. Ray pointed to a large area of relatively flat ground.
"Sea of Tranquility," he declared proudly. "Site of mankind's giant leap."
Jeff squinted.
"Oh, hang on. That can't be. Well, it's no flag or landing craft. It must be in the wrong side or something."
Ray shook his head.
"No, that's definitely it, trust me."
Jeff was aware that he was debating this with an alien space traveller. He was a little out of his depth, to be honest, but he stuck to his guns.
"Wait a minute," he exclaimed in shock. "Are you saying that those myths are true? That we didn't go to the moon at all?"
"No, of course you got to the moon. All the stuff you left there is still on the surface, but it's over on the dark side. Let me show you."
He banked the ship around, and they orbited the moon until they entered the shadowy, hidden half of the moon. Ray put some lights on, and there, in a rocky canyon, was a twinkling pile of NASA's finest technology and some early Russian probes. He turned to Ray.
"Oh, that's nuts! That's unflipping believable. How did all this stuff get over there?"
"Oh, that was the work of the Moonies," replied Ray nonchalantly.
Before Jeff could picture a group of crazy religious cult members in space, Ray explained.
"Well, the Moonies are the inhabitants of the moon. They live beneath the surface and usually don't come out unless there's something to do. They weren't too happy to see all this junk left behind, so they tidied up a bit. It's a sort of museum come scrapyard now. But I have heard that the leader of the Moonies wears a pair of silk star-spangled boxer shorts."
Ray chuckled to himself, and Jeff slumped back in his seat, breathless.
"That's mental,"
Ray agreed.
"Yes, it is. I'd never wear that flag so close to my nether regions."
He returned the screen to its original configuration.
"I'll show you some more things like this as we pass the planets, but we can't see them all. It's a long way to Tipperary, as they say in anywhere except Tipperary."
He flicked some switches and the ship began to accelerate. It was moving at speeds much faster than anything on Earth did, but in the blackness of space, it felt like they were floating calmly in a barge. The remaining planets of the solar system loomed, and as they passed, Ray divulged what few interesting facts he knew about them to a mostly silent and astonished Jeff Spooner.
"Mental,"
he said again to himself, thinking of old black-and-white footage of American astronauts in their fat suits.
Suddenly, he looked down at his feet.
"Here, Ray,"
he called.
"Why aren't we weightless? I was really looking forward to that bit."
Ray turned in his seat.
"Gravity field. Look around the walls and floors."
Jeff did as he was told, and noticed that the floors and walls had tiny round discs embedded into them, about the size of small coins.
"What? So these things stop stuff from floating, then?" surmised Jeff eloquently, pointing to one of the discs.
Ray nodded.
Jeff was just a tad disappointed. "Oh, can't you turn them down for a bit? I'd really like to see what it's like,"
Ray tried to protest. "Space travel isn't a game, Jeff. It involves balance, physics, and complicated calculations, you know."
Jeff felt a sulk coming on.
"Aw, please.
Come on. It's just that weightlessness is probably the coolest thing about space travel, you know? Ray gave in.
Oh, for Bod's sake, all right, but only for half an hour, okay?
Jeff beamed and clapped his hands quickly in front of his chest like a kid who'd just unwrapped a shiny bicycle. Ray remembered that Jeff was good enough to accompany him on his interstellar voyage, and a little fun would keep his guest in high spirits. He unbuckled his seatbelt and joined Jeff, who was standing in the middle of the cabin, still beaming insanely.
Ready?
Asked Ray. Silly question, really. Jeff was born for this moment, if nothing else.
Hold on, Ray. I'd better clip the toilet lid down.
Good thinking, replied Ray. As soon as Jeff came back to the middle of the cabin, Ray reached up to the ceiling and opened a small hexagonal hatch. Inside was a T-shaped handle. He turned the handle anti-clockwise, and the gentle hum which was audible in the cabin shifted down in pitch. As it did so, Jeff was filled with the strangest feeling. His cheeks, both pairs, began to rise up free of their weight. His spine felt less encumbered, and his small but perfectly formed beer belly gurgled as it began to float. He looked down and watched as his feet lifted off the floor gently. Ray had begun to float also, his white barber's coat billowing up around his head. With a whoop of joy, Jeff pushed himself off a wall and floated across the cabin, trying to spin as he went. This was rather boring to Ray, so he pulled out a paperback and just hung in the air, turning the page every minute or so. Jeff squealed with delight as he boinged from wall to floor and floor to ceiling repeatedly. There wasn't much in the way of fun that could compare to the sensation. Except, perhaps, that one time at his 21st birthday party with the strippogram girl and the squirty cream. After 10 fun-filled minutes, Ray decided that it was time to recommence the journey.
Okay, Jeff, he called out. That's enough for now. Maybe later you can play some more, but now it's time to get going again.
Jeff protested with an immature, oh, but Ray was resolute. He grabbed the handle and slowly twisted it clockwise to its original position. Both men floated gently to the floor again. This, too, was a weird feeling. Just like lying in a bath of water while the plug is pulled, everything slowly becomes infused with its correct weight again. Try it. Jeff watched keenly as Ray did this, and Ray noticed.
Don't go playing with this control, Jeff, he warned. I'm serious. Turn it too far, and we'd be pressed to the floor as if we were made of lead, so no touchy.
Jeff held up his hands. Hey, I gotcha. No touchy.
Soon the stars were whizzing past the portholes again.
Jeff sat on the closed toilet lid and relived the past 10 minutes in zero gravity. He grinned foolishly. Looking around, he called over to Ray. Here, Ray, does this ship have a name then or what? He asked, thinking that he might get the opportunity to suggest a title for the fibrous flying machine. Ray continued to pilot the ship but leaned his head back.
Oh, yes, actually it does. I named her after the family pet back home. I call her the Marshmallow Penguin.
Ray pointed to his pink penguin-shaped tie-pin.
Marshmallow Penguin? Repeated Jeff in total incredulity. Well, that's a stupid name for a pet, let alone a spaceship.
No, you misunderstand, continued Ray. Our family pet was a marshmallow penguin. Well, they're common on Kangasang. Similar to penguins on Earth, I suppose, only pink and yellow in colour. Well, very smart animals, but very loyal, very sweet.
So what was your pet penguin's name, then? Something equally mad, I bet.
No, of course not. We called her Tanya.
Jeff threw his head forward into his hands and let out another big sigh of astonishment mixed with a giggle of amusement. He was fast realising that everything he'd ever learnt up until now was a tiny crumb of nothingness,
floating in an endless ocean of undiscovered knowledge. The problem with travelling vast distances is that it soon becomes tedious. Realising he'd had very little actual sleep that night, he put his feet up on the ship's dashboard and watched as the stars whizzed past. He lay back, lacing his fingers together behind his head, and closed his eyes. The humming of the spacecraft's internal systems soon made him drift off to sleep. Ray noticed that his friend had finally woken up.
"Ah, Jeff, had a good sleep.
We're passing through the constellation of Prophania Minor, about 6 light-years from the sun. Take a look." Rubbing his bleary eyes, Jeff looked out. Spread out in front of him was a fantastic sight. A colossal, smoky nebula in clouds of blue and purple. Trillions of stars were scattered among the clouds, looking like an explosion in a sequin factory. He gasped at the wonder of it all. Ray stared ahead, unimpressed. Jeff stretched his arms and yawned.
How long was I sleeping?
Ray looked at his watch and squinted.
About 2 hours. I could do with the rest myself, to be honest.
These long drives certainly take it out of you.
Not too far to go now, though. About another 10 light-years, and we'll be on Kangazang in time for cocktails.
How long would it take?
Oh, let me see. I'd say about 2 days, depending on traffic.
Jeff slumped in disappointment. He'd had nearly enough of being cooped up in this flying toupee and was getting restless. Never mind the fact that he was now the only human being ever to have travelled out of the solar system, or the only man in existence to have seen Pluto with the naked eye. Never mind the fact that his hairdresser was a real living and breathing alien. He was hungry and grumpy. There was plenty of time to be astonished by the wonders of the universe once he'd had a decent meal, a bath, and maybe even a...
"Oh, my God!" exclaimed Jeff. Ray heard, and ran quickly back to the bridge of the ship. Looking out the windscreen feverishly, he scanned the stars for danger.
"Well, what? What is it, Jeff? What do you see?" he asked in panic.
Jeff explained the severity of the situation.
No, it's nothing out there. I just realised something. Something really important."
Ray was getting worried. He held his breath and bit his lip. What could it be? He saw Jeff's concerned expression, the wringing of his hands and the fear in his eyes, and he prepared himself for the worst.
"Where am I going to get a pint?"
asked Jeff in uber-seriousness. Ray exhaled loudly. Then he turned and walked away again. Jeff followed him.
"I'm serious, Ray. I don't think I can last without a couple of pints a week. I should have packed some cans, a bottle of wine, even gin at a push."
Ray looked exasperated.
"I might have guessed.
What is it with you Earthmen and alcohol?"
Jeff tried his best to explain.
"Well, you've got to have a pint now and then, haven't you? It's one of the reasons for going to work, so you can get bladdered on a Friday, isn't it?"
And then he remembered that Ray never went to the pub.
"Ah, you don't drink, do you? Oh, I forgot. I suppose it's poison to you aliens, makes you shrivel up or something."
Ray shook his head.
"Not at all. Not at all. I can drink it. I could probably drink you under the table if I wanted to, but I never touch the stuff."
"Why?"
"Because it makes you act like a total nadumsklep."
Jeff was a little insulted by this, but he didn't want to act upon his feelings, as the only person who knew how to operate the ship was in front of him. He tried another tack.
"Okay, you're a control freak. I'm a free spirit. Each to his own. But seriously, Ray, is there anything like beer on your planet?"
"Of course there is."
Jeff grinned. His life was complete now. Nothing else could dampen his spirits once spirits were dampening his liver.
"The best drinks in the universe are out there. There are lagers that drive you temporarily insane and leave you without a hangover. Stout that would make a leprechaun weep."
"Enough, enough!" exclaimed Jeff, jumping up and down like a 5-year-old. "Where can we get a drink?"
"All right, okay," said Ray, giving in.
"See that group of stars over there?" he indicated to the right.
"Services. We can stop off, get some food. I can stretch my legs and you can have your flipping drink.
The ship headed towards a relatively small solar system. Well, smaller than the only one Jeff knew, at any rate, and headed for a greenish moon a lot smaller than the Earth. Beside it was a huge, sandy beige world shrouded by clouds. Ray and Jeff buckled their seatbelts as a crackle came over the ship's sound system.
Unidentified craft, you are in violation of Ruthenian space. Identify yourself immediately,
said a voice. It was crackly, but it sounded vaguely female. Ray looked ahead and saw two large silver spaceships heading towards them. They were more like the type of spaceship that Jeff expected to see, fish-like and aerodynamically designed. At least they weren't hairy. They glided to within a few hundred metres of Ray's ship and held their positions.
I think we should get out of here, said Ray, feverishly strapping himself in and stabbing buttons on the console. Jeff did the same.
Who are they? Why do they want us?
The voice came through again.
We can hear you, you know. I'll say it again. You are in violation of Ruthenian space. Identify.
Ray and Jeff looked at each other.
I suppose we better had, said Ray. Pulling on the small microphone mounted above his head, he cleared his throat.
Ruthenian authorities, this is Barbaray Sprambladak Fastalon Scump, captain of the Marshmallow Penguin. I'm trying to make a quick stop on your second moon to rest and get some provisions. Is that all right? There was a short crackle. Then the voice came back.
Marshmallow Penguin, identify your passenger.
He leaned into the microphone again.
My passenger is from Earth. His name is Spooner. Listen, if it's all the same to you chaps, we'll be getting out of your hair. So if you'll just let us pass, we'll be...
Desist. You are now prisoners of the Ruthenian Empire and will land on the surface. Any attempt to escape will be met with your immediate destruction. That is all.
Oh, bugger, said Ray.